Let the words of my mouth and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in your sight. O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. Please be seated. And once more, people of God in St. Bede's, good morning. Over the next, actually, this week and next, we will be closing out Genesis, following Joseph, whose story actually claims more chapters than any other character. And in many ways, the story plays out a summation of the book. The 12 sons of Jacob replay and intensify key stories in Jacob's own life, and in actual vocabulary, we see destructive themes replayed from Isaac and Abraham. But there's also going to be immense good as God raises up a seed, a chosen seed, to a place of rule and authority as an image of God. One like Noah, who will rescue humanity from decreation once more. God's divine purposes, remember, is to restore the Eden blessing that was lost, but to restore it to all the nations. That's the end game here. And we look for this full, complete, promised seed that then is further defined in the story of Joseph. And it seems like a lot to unpack, but I believe the opening of our reading conveys this intent. And so looking at the 37th chapter of the book of Genesis, beginning with verse 1. Now Jacob dwelt in the land where his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. We are instantly reminded that Jacob lives where his father Isaac and his grandfather Abraham, where they dwelt as strangers. Strangers in a land they were promised by God. But yet there is not yet the inheritance of the land. And so the chapter continues. Verse 2, this is the history of Jacob. Now remember at this point, Jacob is also known by the name given by God, Israel. So by this, we expect the remainder of Jacob's life to be full center. Or is it Israel's? Is it Jacob? Or is it Israel? And in the crafting of the narrative, the answer is yes. But it's told through the story of one son, Joseph. The story about God's people is told through the story of one promised son. Joseph is the first son of Rachel, Jacob's favored wife. And prior to his birth, back in chapter 30, Rachel demanded of Jacob, "Give me children or else I die." Her simmering frustration, her impetuousness is actually similar to her brother-in-law Esau. "Give me that stew, or else I'm going to die." And it's actually met with a very callous response from Jacob. Despite being the favored wife, Jacob seems to shrug off Rachel's underlying pain of being infertile. So then Rachel then falls back to the strategy, like Sarah with Hagar, and gives Jacob her servant, who then births two sons. And after long years of frustrated hopes and prayers, the gift of a son to Rachel is finally given in this rapid fire, this represented in this rapid fire chain of verbs in a single verse. God remembered, God heard, God opened, then Rachel conceived, and Rachel bore. Joseph's name is a mixed meaning of Hebrew. It means take away, as Rachel announces that her shame has been taken away by God. But it also can mean add to, as she reiterates her demand. Remember, she said, "Give me children." not a child, I want children. And eventually Rachel will have another son, but she will die giving birth to Benjamin, perhaps in response to her rash words, "Give me children or else I die," a foreshadowing of her premature death. Well, our lesson today conveys that Joseph may still yet be a child, at least in the way he utilizes the wisdom Yahweh provided him. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brothers, and he brought a bad report to his father about his brothers. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age, and he also made him a tunic of many colors. Now I think everybody knows what snitches get. Growing up on the rough streets of Alamogordo, Wendy knows. Snitches get stitches. Of both kinds. As I was thinking about this, I thought, this can't be where that phrase came from, is it? Negatively, because of the future treatment that he's going to get from his brother. But not before the promised positive gift of this finely stitched coat. But for the brothers, the tattletale had this special garment, and it's clear that their father's clear favoritism has riled them up. And he's the favorite because, as the text says, he was the son of his old age. And again, we're going back to moments earlier in Genesis. What Isaac was to Abraham, Joseph is to Jacob, the son of his old age. And the uneven love repeats that which Isaac had for Esau and Rebekah had for Jacob in that story. So when his brothers saw that Jacob loved Joseph more, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. And that draws us back to Cain. Like Cain and Esau, the animal, sin, which sought to devour them, is brewing in their hearts, yearning for action and release. And then Joseph's next report and Jacob's benign response seems to give them the perfect excuse to act. So Joseph had a dream, and he told it to his brothers, and they hated him even more. So he said to them, "Please hear this dream which I have dreamed. There we were binding sheaves in the field, and then behold, my sheaf arose and also stood upright, and indeed your sheaves stood all around and bowed down to me." And well, gosh, gee, brothers, what do you think that could mean? And his brother said to him, "You little twerp, all of 17 years old, shall you indeed reign over us? Or shall you indeed have dominion over us?" Well, the answer is on hold for now. So they hated him even more. This word is repeated more in this chapter of Genesis than anywhere else, that hate. They hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. All right, Joseph. Let's read the room here. Nope. He had another dream. And he told it to his brothers and said, "Look, I have dreamed another dream, and this time the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars bowed down to me." And guys, it was so weird. The whole universe was bowing down to me. And what he says, again, the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars were bowing down to him. The only other time that that phrase is used is back in the Genesis scroll in the creation narrative. The sun and the moon and the stars, they were the hosts of the heaven. that were put there to rule over the sky and the calendar and the time and day and night. And so we're calling back to this image of God in Genesis 1, but even more than that, because the image of God was called to rule over the land, just as the rulers of the sky were to rule there. But now a man has a dream about becoming the ruler over all of God's creation and its inhabitants. And so he, Joseph, told it to his father and his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said to him, "What is this that you are dreaming? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come to bow down to earth before you?" And his brothers envied him. But his father kept the matter in mind. This hate, this anger, this frustration, it's growing within the brothers and among them. And yet it doesn't seem like Jacob is doing anything to quell it. In fact, his next actions, not really well thought out. His brothers went to feed their flocks in Shechem. And Israel, Jacob, said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers out there in Shechem? Go, send them to him." And Joseph's response is, "Here I am." That little jingle of that common response of God's chosen one. "Here I am. Send me." Then Jacob said to Joseph, "Please go and see if it is well with your brothers." So he sent him out, and he went to Shechem. And you may recall, this is a story that we didn't look at very closely, but Shechem is that area where Simeon and Levi had slaughtered all the men, along with Hamor and Shechem, who had sexually assaulted their sister Dinah. So Jacob sends Joseph out to that area. And eventually he's guided to his brothers. And so they see him coming far off. And as the text says, they conspired. They conspired. They hatched a plan of deceit to kill him. And they said to one another, "Look, this dreamer is coming." And they've waited long enough, but notice the setting. Just like Cain and Abel went out into a field, now Joseph's brothers are out in that field. That field where the beast, that snake, came from. And their plan for murder is the same word used for what Cain does to Abel out in that field. And the comparisons continue. "Come, therefore, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit. And we shall say some wild beast has devoured him. We'll see what becomes of his dreams." So again, Genesis 3 and 4 are echoing here. The snake of the field that told a lie to the human. And that wild beast who was waiting to devour. The brothers, they're repeating these destructive themes. And Reuben, he tries to step up and hatch a plan to just put him in a pit for now. And somehow he would go secretly back and rescue Joseph and return him to Jacob. But for now, when Joseph arrives, they strip that tunic off of him. They've had enough of that. And they took him and cast him into a pit. And so here we've had this dream about Joseph being exalted up high. High over his brothers, even over the sun and the moon and the stars. And what his brothers do instead is to take him down into the pit, below the ground. He goes from one cosmos, one end of the cosmos to the other, so to speak. But the brothers, oh, they were so distraught. They felt such guilt about what they did that they sat down to eat a meal. And the text suggests that they ate the meal right next to where Joseph was. Because later in chapter 42, when they were feeling guilty, they described how they ignored the pleading of Joseph as he remained in that pit. And once more, deception over a meal. We've heard that before. The garden, Isaac, Jacob, and we'll hear it again. But for now, Joseph is trapped in a pit by his brothers, who have authority over him. And yet later, when Joseph is exalted up over his brothers, he also will use some deception around a meal. Well, then in comes Judah. Judah convinces them to sell Joseph as a slave. I mean, why kill him when we can profit from him? I mean, that just makes common sense, doesn't it? Well, it's the deception of sin. And we know that. When we pat ourselves on the back for choosing the lesser of two evils, but not recognizing that we're still choosing evil. So Joseph is loaded onto a caravan headed down to Egypt. And the text invites us to share in this agony that Joseph is now being further removed from his home, his family, from safety. Just as Adam and Eve were exiled out of the garden, out of Eden, Joseph too went out from his family, out into the field. And then the direction is down. And this is a parallel to exile. Joseph went down into a pit, down to Egypt, and then later further down into a prison. And we too have probably felt this pull away from God, sometimes by our own sin, other times by the circumstances that seem to separate us from Him. To be pulled out, away, and down. Well, regretfully, the brothers are not done. In an act of disturbing irony, they use a garment dipped in the blood of a goat to deceive their father, similar to how Jacob dressed up as a goat to deceive his father, Isaac. And then Jacob tears his clothes, put sackcloth on his waist, and mourned for his son many days. And all his sons and daughters, they arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. Now just think about that. Knowing what you've done, you're still trying to comfort your father in his grief. The irony is that Jacob thinks that a wild animal has eaten his son, and in a way, that's true. It's just that the wild animals are his children. Children that have become overwhelmed by sin, and they're continuing the ruse. Again, the deception of sin. When the consequences are not immediately apparent, you think you've gotten away with it. For Jacob, he draws the depth of the exile away from God further yet, away from God's presence and care. He said, "For I shall go down into the grave to my son in mourning." The narrative is marking, again, a series of descent. And Jacob unknowingly qualifies the descent down to the pit is down to the grave, to death. Later in the story, Joseph is going to call his prison my pit. And so death is introduced as a type of exile. But yet we've heard that already, haven't we? The Eden story taught us that. In the day you eat of the fruit, you will surely die. And then in the narrative, the day that they eat of it, they're exiled. They're separated from God, cut off from God, cut off from neighbor, cursed. It's void of God's death, God's blessing. It is death. So it seems that you can be in a state of death and be physically alive in the biblical story. And what they all don't realize is, in our reading today, is that if things don't turn around for Joseph, if he stays in the pit, if he stays in the grave in Egypt in prison, they all, along with Joseph, will actually die. But even worse, it's the brothers' sin, along with their refusal to admit it to their father, which can lead to the exile of eternal death. And without repentance, it can be the same with us. The patriarchs needed the promises of God repeated because, well, look at what they have done. We've seen their stories again and again. We need the gospel repeated because, well, look at what we have done. It is necessary for us to hear the gospel again and again and again. To know who God is, to know who we are, and what God has done for us, even in spite of that self-awareness. But it's not to leave us there. This may be an uncomfortable ending to the sermon today. We all like a story that just kind of gets wrapped up in a bow, given an ending. And we are told at the end of Genesis 39 that Yahweh was with Joseph in the pit. He was with him. He doesn't prevent it from happening. But that doesn't mean that Yahweh isn't there. And that's something in the story that I think we all have to sit and ponder what that means. A dear friend of Wendy and I's, he used to always say, "Don't waste your suffering. Don't seek suffering without any regard to safety, but don't waste your suffering." It may be a great mistake to try and remove your afflictions in haste before you are sanctified and grow through them. Many would leap out the window before God would come and open the door. And yet, when a firefighter meets you in the middle of a blazing fire, would you be happy if he just kind of sat down next to you? "Hey, how you doing?" No, you want to be rescued. You want to be lifted up and carried out back to the presence of safety and life. And yet, how would you feel that as you reached that safety, you looked back and that firefighter was burning and dying in your place? God's chosen servant, Joseph, is exiled out and down, just as Hebrews describes Christ going outside the city and later down to the depths of the grave. But for now, we pause the story as Joseph, either strengthened or confused by his dreams of glory, descends further away.